From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard Magazine. Joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. And here are the issues. President Trump, in his first address to a joint session of Congress, proposed a large buildup in the American military and a reduction in spending for the State Department and foreign aid. Meanwhile, Attorney General Jeff Sessions was forced to recuse himself, that means drop out, from any investigation of Russia's efforts to disrupt the 2016 presidential election. He is accused of lying or misleading the Senate when asked last year about any meeting he had with Russian officials. Well, let's start with President Trump's somewhat unusual speech to a joint session of Congress. Lasted 60 minutes. David, what'd you make of it?
So I think one of the really interesting puzzles that Donald Trump presents us here in Washington is, by this point in a presidency, we would expect to have a pretty clear sense about what a new president, particularly one whose party controls every branch of government, you'd want to know what they're going to do. And there are some big open questions. They have plans to change the way that people are covered for healthcare in this country. They have big plans for how to reshape the budget, as you say, towards much more kind of national security, law and order, and that would be paid for by scrapping things like foreign aid. There are some big live debates within the Republican Party about how you use the tax system to encourage exports but to discourage imports. And those are big divides. And normally, around this point, you would expect the president to take the lead and to give a signal and try and make the case for some ways forward through these sort of thickets of disagreement. And the speech that Donald Trump gave, which was kind of the equivalent of a State of the Union speech, but slightly different because it's his first year, that speech was essentially detail-free. Almost all of those big open questions about what he wants to do were left completely unanswered. And yet, here's the puzzle. If you go into the country, as I do and others do, and talk to Trump supporters, they are delighted. They're absolutely convinced that Donald Trump is keeping his promises, that he's doing what he said he would do, that that makes him stand out as a very unusual politician. They couldn't be happier. So how do you square that circle? Why is it that, given that we don't know what he's doing, his supporters are so sure he's keeping his promises? My hunch, watching that speech and thinking about it this week, is that the core to Donald Trump, again and again, is it's not what he plans to do, it's who he plans to do it for. He keeps talking about how everything the government does must be done in the interests of American citizens, true Americans, hardworking Americans, decent Americans. So his pitch, to a really unusual degree, is about being the champion of a particular group of people, his supporters, and more broadly, American citizens, not foreigners, not illegal immigrants, not hostile competitors in trade. He's a champion. It's who he's for, not what he does. And I think that was kind of the hidden message in this speech.
Well, it wasn't that hidden, but I'm glad you mentioned it because it was an important part of it. Michael?
I think stylistically, to talk about that, he comes in with, I think, kind of a very low bar, you know, and low expectations for that type of thing. You know, given the types of speeches that we've seen him give up until now, they've been very much sort of the campaign and sort of Sturm und Drang, you know, that really throws red meat to his base. So he did come in and look, quote unquote, presidential. I mean, he stayed on the teleprompter. He stayed hinged, as many people have called him, unhinged in certain types of speeches. But he was very, I think, sort of somber and respectful and struck a lot of the right notes that you would expect in a speech in that type of environment and to that type of audience. There were very touching moments, such as when he recognized the widow of the Navy SEAL who was lost in a raid recently in Yemen. It was somewhat presidential. Having said that, it wasn't really much more than sort of a redecoration of a campaign speech. As David says, he really didn't point to any solutions. He really just pointed vigorously to all of the problems and the questions and set them out and said, we need to solve these things. But there really weren't any sort of solid solutions to this thing. I think that as he goes forward, he really does have to set up sort of an agenda for how we're going to solve these things. Because he set out some really Gordian knot types of things. Like, how do you expand the military budget, expand infrastructure spending, expand this health care plan that's going to cover everyone, and also give great tax cuts to the corporate and to the middle class? How do you do all of these things and afford any of it? At this point, the politics and the math don't make sense. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes forward.
It'll be interesting, but I think you all are asking too much from a speech. Look, I've heard dozens of State of the Union addresses, and this is somewhat comparable to it, as you mentioned, David, but they're always vague. They're not a whole lot of details in it, but look, here's some of the things he was clear on. He said he is going to build a wall along the southwest border between the U.S. and Mexico. Now, that's not new, but this is the first time he said it to a joint session of Congress. He's for tax reform, and he said it's going to include, and this is the main thing I think he's interested in, a cut in the corporate tax rate. And even President Obama was for one. He didn't do anything to actually achieve one, but he did one. And I'll have to say some of the other stuff was pretty vague. He wants to renegotiate trade treaties. Well, a lot of the partners on trade treaties aren't going to want to do that. Michael, you mentioned the style. I thought the style was important because it's not the more slam-bang style that we've seen in his campaign addresses, but we have seen it before. In October, the last month of the campaign, remember his polls went down. It was after that Access Hollywood tape came out, you know, with all the raunchy language coming from Donald Trump. And he started giving substantive speeches about issues using a teleprompter, as of course he did the other night. So we've seen it before, not that often, but I think we're going to see a lot more of it. What about this question, David, about a military buildup? Trump talked about it in the campaign. I've heard conservatives say, well, $50 billion is a drop in the bucket. That's not going to do much.
So at the moment, the U.S. military spends about $600 billion a year, which is more than the next 13 countries put together. So that is, in one way, the simplest explanation is America spends a staggering amount of money on the military. It is, however, the case, if you talk to people who study the Pentagon budget, there are problems with things like deferred maintenance. There are kind of ships that aren't actually, you know, able to sail. The number of American combat troops who are ready to go into combat tomorrow with the right kit in working order is surprisingly low. So there are problems with the Pentagon budget, which is why, in fact, had the Democrats won the White House, President Obama was proposing to increase the budget by quite a lot of money, you know, about $19 billion. So there are people saying that actually the proposal that we saw floated, which is to more or less add 10% to the defense budget, sounds like a lot of money. It is a lot of money, but it's not a kind of transformational change. I think that actually what may become more politically interesting is the way that Donald Trump's team is planning to try and offset some of these increases to the defense budget. That, I think, would take us into uncharted territory. Because his team is very resistant to the idea of raising new revenue by creating, say, new taxes on imports, which is one suggestion you see among some Republicans in the House, there is a need to make very deep cuts. And actually, a lot of the federal budget can't really be easily touched because it's things like pensions for old people or healthcare for old people. There's a lot of essentially automatic spending. So the slice of the budget that you can change year in, year out is rather small. And if we believe the headline numbers, some of the proposals would essentially eviscerate things like the State Department. You're talking about 38% cuts to their budget. That's one of the suggestions we've seen out there. Now, the State Department doesn't actually cost a huge amount of money, but it's true that a lot of Republicans don't like the State Department. They think it's basically a bunch of lefties who like foreigners too much, sort of drinking champagne with foreigners in foreign kind of palaces, and, you know, what's not to like?
Cut that to ribbons. You mean that's not true?
Well, here's the thing.
I'm kidding.
If you're a defender of the State Department, and you have seen this happen this week, you would point to smart guys like the new Defense Secretary General Mattis, who back in 2013 gave a speech when he was the commander of Central Command, who said, if you cut the State Department budget, you're going to need to let me buy more ammunition. Because if we can't head off conflicts diplomatically, I'm going to have to fight them. And so I think that is a reasonable argument. And it was really interesting that after they proposed those big cuts.
I thought you mentioned it, but what is it? How many generals was it, retired generals?
112 or something?
Thought it was more than that. Don't do this. Don't do this.
There's also the great factoid. The great factoid that the entire budget of the State Department is the same as the Pentagon spends on military bands and music.
You know, I'm so used to this because Republican presidents, more so Donald Trump, but have made proposals like this before. The State Department, they're particularly cutting foreign aid, and they may trim it a little, but it's sort of a first offer, and it usually doesn't get very far.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about the size of the budget and put it in perspective. President Trump is talking about the increase being one of the largest in history, which it really very much is not. It's a 10% increase we're talking about. That there have been, I think, 4 10% increases since 2002. It's a fairly routine type of thing.
Well, certainly
ask,
Reagan's military buildup was a lot bigger, too.
And, anyway. And 10 increases since 1977. Mm-hmm. So it's about what people expect when we talk about $54 billion. But still, it is a lot of money. The way to go about it, though, is, you know, if you're not going to touch entitlements, you're talking about gutting essential departments and essential services. And Senators Lindsey Graham and John McCain have already called it a non-starter. I think Lindsey Graham called it naive to think that you were going to take soft power away as a tool for the U.S. government to deal with foreign policy problems. So this type of thing, when you take it to a budget and try to make it a practical thing, again, you get the politics and the math, and how do you make those things work out? The guy who has to get this done is Paul Ryan, you know, the Speaker of the House on the Hill, who has to somehow cobble together a budget out of these conflicting types of issues. And the money really, it just doesn't work. I mean, that's the bottom line. It just can't happen. So what it causes then, I think, is undue stress and fissures in what are cracks in this so far unified Republican Party. There are sort of cracks and fissures between the hardliners and the Trumpistas and that sort of thing. So these splits might become chasms, you know, in the fight for how to get this type of budget done.
Well, there is one way they're trying to raise money. And David, you mentioned it, and that's this tax on imports and coming into the United States, this so-called border tax. And it's extremely controversial among Republicans. I don't think it's going to live very long. I don't think it'll be a part of a tax bill because it splits the business community. So many retailers in particular, and the business community is basically part of the Republican coalition, and they've been out there very strong against it.
One of the really interesting things about Donald Trump is that, you know, politics is, among other things, the business of painful trade-offs, where these are all the things we've been discussing so far. As a campaigner, as an outsider, as a non-traditional kind of politician, Donald Trump is, more than most politicians, unwilling to accept that there are painful trade-offs. So I remember interviewing Donald Trump last year and asking him about, okay, so say you slap that time I wasn't talking about the border tax, I was talking about taxes on, say, Chinese imports that he was talking about. And I said to him in this interview, so if you slap a 30% tax on Chinese imports, that pushes the price up of everything in Walmart, and a lot of your voters shop at Walmart. So, you know, how are they going to feel when prices in Walmart go up 30%? His answer to me was amazingly kind of casual. He said, and this was, you know, before he was president, but he said, oh, you know, my guys, you know, at the moment, maybe they go to Walmart and they buy like three dolls for their daughter. Maybe they have to buy one doll for their daughter, but they'll have a great job, so everyone will be happy. And I think that that's one of the things.
You didn't find that satisfactory?
It wasn't quite the macroeconomic kind of guidance that I was seeking. And I think what that points to is that Donald Trump has secured this astonishing historic victory, getting elected as president, by essentially saying that people can have their cake and eat it, and there will be no painful trade-offs. And now he is finding himself, you know, faced with the very hard business of governing. One thing I'd love to know what you think as well. You have excellent sources on Capitol Hill with Republicans. My gut instinct is that increasingly, I wonder if the way they're going to get through this is actually by just blowing the deficit and borrowing a lot of money and then promising themselves that they will, you know, be good later and face the public finances later.
The panacea here is economic growth.
Yes.
Economic growth generates more tax revenues, and then the deficit doesn't get that much bigger. I'm going to ask one more question about Trump and his speech, but first, let me take a break and remind you that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show today are Michael Williams of CBS Radio and David Remney of The Economist. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And my final question is Donald Trump's emphasis in this speech. Now, he has said these three words before: radical Islamic terrorism. But he's never said them at a joint session of Congress in a speech that's watched by millions of people around the world and so on. And he emphasized, remember, he said them somewhat slowly. He wanted to emphasize it. There have been reports that his new national security advisor, General McAllister, didn't want him to do it, and others didn't. But, Michael, what about it? I mean, I think Trump was going to say it regardless of what any of his aides thought.
Absolutely, positively. This was sort of bursting the bubble that had been waiting for that to be said over the microphone by Republicans and conservatives for the 8 years of the Obama administration, who absolutely refused, and the whole administration refused to use that term, feeling that it would incite radical Islamic terrorism rather than quell it, to try to call it a name in that fashion. So, yeah, I think, again, that's another campaign promise met that's very easy to do. Mm-hmm. You know, when you can fulfill these campaign promises with rhetoric, then, you know, by all means, go ahead and do it. Doesn't cost anything. You know, it takes a few sentences. But when they have to be solved with money and actual working solutions, as the other things we've talked about so far, that's a different thing.
You want to say something about that, David, or can we...
So I think there's a danger that people were told... Essentially, there's a conspiracy theory behind saying those three words. The conspiracy theory is that the Obama administration, and Trump sometimes hinted this might be because there was some dark, mysterious secret around Obama and his kind of affinity for Muslims, which was kind of playing to the worst kind of conspiracy theories, that because they would not say the words radical Islamic terrorism, that made it substantially harder to defeat radical Islamic terrorism. I think that that misses another point, which is that it is impossible, I think, to see America and its allies defeating or curbing or containing the threat of people like Islamic State, the extremist group, without the help of moderate Muslims or without the help of Muslim allies. And if the truth is that constantly harping on the fact that this is an Islamic form of terrorism done by Muslims makes it harder for the Iraqi government or the Jordanian government or the Egyptian government to help you, then listen to them and think about the trade-offs.
Well, there are trade-offs. I think this a disagreement, and I think there's some legitimacy to what Trump has done, and certainly to the other side, too. We're going to hear more about it. Okay. Senator Jeff Sessions. Senator Sessions is, I say senator, he's now the Attorney General of the United States. He's been confirmed. And this question has come up. He had said in his testimony that led to his confirmation as Attorney General that he had not met with Russian officials in the last year. And it turned out he was in a group that saw, I guess, the Russian ambassador at the Republican convention in Cleveland. That was a public event. But in September, he saw the Russian ambassador in his office on Capitol Hill. Democrats are saying he lied about it. Jeff Sessions took a very narrow view of the question, that it was, well, they were asking me, did I meet with somebody as a leader, an official in, well, not an official, but someone who was very involved in the Trump presidential campaign. And he said, well, no, he didn't meet the Russian ambassador as that. He was meeting him as a senator, and they talked about terrorism and so on. All right, Michael, where does this go?
Well, I think what you had was giving a lawyerly answer, you know, at best.
Certainly true.
You know, it's a very lawyerly answer. And if he isn't lying, if he isn't fabricating at the very least, you can see, obviously, where it raises some questions for people. Like, how could you possibly forget this? How could you parse this closely, given the politics, given the situation of the thing? How could you possibly do that unless you were trying to conceal something? So there's that issue there. Just what did he intend to do? What is his intent? And people are talking about perjury and he should resign. That's a very high bar when you talk about perjury, because I believe that the legal standard is that you have to know, you have to be willing to conceal knowledge or intending to conceal knowledge. So there's that whole issue. The other thing is, it's a problem because you have Attorney General Sessions giving an answer that's very much like the type of answer that Republicans excoriated Hillary Clinton for years and years and years. It was so Clinton-esque in both its the answer itself and the explanation. I mean, it could have come out the Clinton Hall of Fame the way it was. So that's a problem, too.
That's a very good point. I hadn't thought of that.
Enough of this already from both. Do we have to get it from both sides now? And again, look, he has to recuse himself. He really does. The problem is he has to be involved in this investigation now. He's not recusing himself from the investigation of things that are going on in the FBI that have to do with criminal intent. And that goes back to Michael Flynn. He hasn't recused himself from that. So it's a sticky wicket, I think, is what you'd call it.
David. All right, David.
Look, I cannot predict where this will go. What I do think is really important to point out is that the White House, in defending itself, like all White Houses, is setting up a straw man. So the White House is saying Democrats and Obama and their allies in the intelligence community are trying to make a case that the Russians somehow affected the way that, you know, the vote happened and stole the election. And because they can't prove that, there's nothing to see. Move on. Let's carry on. That's not actually what anyone is claiming, although that's what the White House says they're claiming. It's what Donald Trump put out in a statement that the Democrats are trying to cover up the reason they lost the election. Take a step back. That's not what anyone is claiming. What we know for a fact is that hackers broke into the computers of the Democratic National Committee and into the email server of the top boss at the Clinton campaign during the election, stole emails. And then those emails, those stolen emails, the most embarrassing ones that they could find, were put out by the WikiLeaks anti-secrecy website. So that was a deliberate attempt to embarrass one of the two candidates in the presidential election. And the evidence is that that stealing of those emails was done by Russian intelligence. Mm-hmm. So we know that that's what happened. You don't have to prove that that then affected the result of the election. Mm-hmm. But someone attacked American democracy with the intention of helping Donald Trump.
But here's what I think they're really looking at, and that is whether there was collusion
So that's what I'm getting to. So we need to pin down, because the White House is covering itself by saying, if you can't prove this gigantic thing, then go away. But you don't have to prove the gigantic thing that Russia changed the result of the election. We know that emails were stolen and distributed to hurt Hillary Clinton. We know that because we saw them. Everyone read them. So that happened. What we're trying to establish is, given that that stealing of emails and distribution of those emails helped Donald Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton, was the Trump campaign egging the Russians on and saying, make sure you get those out while it's still useful to us? And were there quid pro quos? Because, among other things, at the Republican National Convention in the summer, when the Republican Party set this, frankly, rather symbolic party platform of setting out their policy, Trump campaign people intervened to change the language around Ukraine and Russia to make it more Russia-friendly. And if that was a quid pro quo for releasing stolen emails to Hillary Clinton, then you could make a case, I would make the case, that the Trump campaign was helping a hostile foreign power that is no friend to the United States attack American democracy for reasons that suited Russian foreign policy.
I know, but those were Trump's views about Russia. I don't happen to agree with them, and I think most Republicans don't agree with them. But actually, I think what they are looking for, and haven't found any evidence that there was actual collusion on the part of Trump, well, they said associates or members of the Trump campaign, people who had been in touch with Russians of one sort or another, but they haven't found any of that collusion. And that is the bottom line of what they have to find if, for instance, they're going to have a scandal that will harm the Trump administration, perhaps irreparably.
But there we completely agree. You're absolutely right. That the key is whether there was collusion.
Yeah.
But that's why it matters that during the campaign, the Trump campaign said there was absolutely no contact of any sort between Trump campaign people and the Russian government. And now, and we don't yet know what was said, that's why it matters that the new Attorney General, when he was a Trump campaign surrogate, met the Russian ambassador and forgot to mention that when he was directly asked during his confirmation hearing, had he met anyone from the Russian government?
You know, some people have written, Charles Krauthammer has written this, but many others have, that you have here a cover-up, a seeming cover-up on the part of the Trump people when there's really not a scandal yet. I mean, Jeff Sessions, all he had to say was, I didn't meet the ambassador as a campaign official, but I did talk to him. Instead, he didn't admit that there had been the meeting.
And that's my problem, Fred. If there's no there, then why do people keep lying about it? Why do people keep forgetting these very smart, very capable men?
It's a fair question.
Keep forgetting these very, very important and significant meetings. And I think we need to think about what the end game is here. What if we found out everybody in the campaign spoke to somebody in Russia? You know, what is the end game here? You know, are we going to indict? Are we going to impeach? You know, what are we actually getting at here? Somebody better start thinking about that thing, because it's coming down the track like a freight train.
It is. Here's my final question. Watching Trump's speech, it was a conventional speech to Congress for a president. I've heard many like that. It may not have been what we expected from Trump, but it was pretty conventional. My view is that Trump, we're going to see as president, is going to be somewhat of a conventional politician who does things that you have to be different when you're appearing before a joint session of Congress and when you're going to speak to the Conservative Political Action Conference. And he just responds to these things, the political necessities, the way a conventional politician does for the most part.
I think that you're probably right. That's what he's done now. He started to show different gears. You know, we had sort of regal Trump, presidential Trump. We've had stump Trump. And you know, these are all different characters. And if you have different toolkits and you're able to use them, that's fine. The thing that I'd really love to see is just that Twitter stop. That would be just marvelous for all
David.
Of us.
I think you're being a little bit too easy on him. I think that although his tone was gentler and milder, let's think of one of the things he did. He had guests in the gallery, four guests he pointed to, who said that these were people whose relatives had been viciously murdered by illegal immigrants, that he was going to set up a special government unit whose job will be to help people murdered by illegal immigrants and their families, and to publicize and report on crimes committed by illegal immigrants. Now, any murder is a very serious thing. It's clearly upsetting when a murder is committed by someone who shouldn't even be in the country. But these are a very small number of murders. And to single out murders committed by illegal immigrants and have a government office whose job is to publicize murders committed by illegal immigrants. Imagine if that office was to publicize murders committed by Catholics and only murders committed by Catholics. I think everyone would smell a rat. They would think this is an incitement to bigotry. And that was in this calm, moderate, mild speech. I don't think that was remotely presidential.
That's all the time we have. Joining us today were David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.